to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People, with me, your host, Ollie Rear. I am back after a week or two off. I hear that Dave, who is joining me here for this intro, did an at least respectable job of hosting while I was away, although I heard the term Ollie Days banded around quite a lot. So I hope that wasn't too off-putting to anyone.
Yeah. Now you're back, I won't say it, but in that sense, but it's great to have you back, Ollie. It's I'm not sure if there's a difference between doing a respectable job and just doing a job, and I'm not quite sure which I'm not quite sure which one I was in, but I'm glad to have you back. It's you've certainly been missed on the sessions.
Well, I did okay today, but it was a bit rusty, I'll be honest with you. But it was still a very good session, a very enjoyable one. So this week we had a very special session where we were joined by two guests. It wasn't just the two of us. So we had Trudy Ogden, Lottery Manager at St Anne's Hospice on, and we also had Theresa Nightingale, Income Generation and Marketing Director at Wirral Hospice St John's. And if you hadn't guessed yet by their job titles and where they work, we were speaking about fundraising and income generation within the hospice sector specifically. Now, while that might sound very narrow, please don't turn off just yet, because actually there's a lot of valuable insights and learning to be gleaned from this session, I think, even if you're not specifically affected by those topics. Would you agree with that, Dave?
And I certainly would. I mean, it's the hospice sector is something that's really keen to, well, it's a real interest of mine, because I used to work in the sector for many years in direct marketing. So I've had the practical experience of delivering direct marketing, delivering income lines, working with a range of different suppliers within the sector in that sense. Prior to, well, I carried a bit of knowledge on data protection anyway, but prior to the GDPR coming in to what we're doing now. So I think there's a lots of little bits in there that I'm sure a lot of people in the hospice sector could take from that, bits that they'll learn and can develop, and also bits that might just settle some of the myths that are around there, you find some organizations have a fear of the GDPR and are frozen because they're not quite sure what to do or where to go for information and advice. And I think today has been a real mix of information that'll be some of real value to the charity sector, not just hospices specific, but charity sector working within fundraising or raising funds for the cause that they work for.
Yeah, I think that's true. My headphones have just died, by the way, so apologies if there's any disruption in relation to that. I'm really struggling today. I've come back, I'm all rusty. And
you've come back for half a week and you're needing a couple of days off.
Yeah, well, just between you, me and the listeners, I came back from my holidays and instantly caught COVID. So I've been battling that for the past few days, which has been quite the return to work. But go on.
I was going to say, if anybody's listening to the podcast while on holiday, there may be a little learning in there.
Yes, not for me to say what that would be, but
come back from holiday.
Yeah, I was going to say nothing will stop me from doing the podcast, and certainly not this one, because it was a good episode. But all I was going to say there is that, yes, absolutely, there's a lot of learning to be had from this, and not just, I think, from the charity sector. I think actually, Dave, I'm going to expand that and say I think there's a lot of private sector still that could benefit hugely from what we discussed today. So it's a really good topic.
For sure.
We had a lot of fun discussing it, some really good insights talking about it. You will notice possibly that the recording possibly starts a little bit later than we would normally do, and that is again down to me being a bit rusty and realizing that no one was recording until a couple of minutes in. So apologies about that, but hopefully Miles will do a fab job of editing this and putting it out. In terms of broader news for DPP, all the usual is still going on, plenty of events every week. There'll be a session, whether it's GDPR radio or a specific session. So next week, obviously, it'll just be GDPR radio. But after that, we've got plenty of theme sessions coming up, which should be jam-packed and plenty of fun. And also, first and foremost, very interesting. So we've got some guests lined up for those. We've got some specific topics. But if there's anything at all that you want to see, that you want to discuss, anything that you think we've not covered sufficiently in the past, or just that you come across yourself and you think might be worth raising, please do get in touch with us. Give us some suggestions on how we might run future sessions. And that's whether it's topics or just generally suggestions for how we might improve the format as well. We're always open to feedback, criticism, etc. So please do get in touch with anything like that. If you want to participate in the sessions yourself or want to come along to the live ones, you've just been a podcast listener until now, also get in touch via the socials. We can get that arranged for you. Last thing, I've not badgered you about this for a while, but if you are listening on Spotify, then we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a little rating. It helps us grow our community, it helps us grow the podcast, and ultimately that benefits you, the listener, hopefully. I've done a lot of talking, Dave. Anything else before we let them get stuck into today's session?
For sure. I'm not suggesting that there's a great deal of celebrity status with the podcast, but anybody who follows it purely just for myself, I'm on leave like Ollie took last week. I'll be away for the next couple of weeks, so I won't be around. I know there's a few people do like the little soapbox moment, so if I can hand that mantle over to you as you handed over the comparing of the session to me last week, that would be much appreciated, Ollie.
I'll do my best. I'll try and rope Phil in. I'll rile him up about something. I know how to push Phil's buttons generally, so I'll try and get him on his soapbox about something. So I'm sure we'll manage without you. Without further ado, we will let you get stuck into this session. So I will leave you in the very capable hands of David Holmes, Trudy Ogden, Teresa Nightingale, and back from the brink myself. Before we start talking about the main topic for today, we'd like to take a look at what's been in the news recently from a data protection, privacy and compliance perspective. Dave, I know there's one you want to talk about. We'll just go through them pretty quickly because we want to get stuck into the main topic. But I know there's one that you wanted to cover, so floor's all yours.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. So it's just one that's come up recently with the ICO, and it's took us solicitors, and the ICO investigated them, and they has fined a solicitor firm £98,000 in essence for failure to ensure appropriate security under the relevant articles that rendered it vulnerable to a ransomware attack. So as a consequence of a ransomware attack, they got a fine from the Information Commissioner's Office for £98,000. As a consequence of that and the ransomware attack, there was 972,000 individuals' files had been encrypted, and some of them do read the output from that is pretty good, but the 972,000 files, so although the major bit that the ICO focused on was the being vulnerable to a cyber attack, having failed to ensure appropriate security, there were minor elements that they looked at, such as storage limitation and keeping information for far too long, having data protection and privacy by design and default not in there, and not being able to have the ability to ensure ongoing confidentiality, integrity or availability of information, or the resilience of the processing systems and services. And what's quite interesting for me, other than the fact that the ICO appeared to be looking into other areas, not just straight down the ransomware there, they kind of looked at things like there was a patch update that had been applied, but there's a 5-month period between the patch update coming out and the patch update being applied, and kind of considerations as to whether that led to the attack or not. There's no multi-factor authentication in place for remote access. The more interesting one for myself was the fact that actually their own GDPR and data protection policy suggested that all software operating systems and firmware shall be updated on a regular basis to reduce the risks presented by security vulnerabilities, which is just another essence of we've got to make sure our policies aren't going to hang ourselves. And I've certainly seen this kind of time and time again, which is another reason why it was quite interesting there. And also the Solicitors' Own Regulation Authority came out and said that solicitors are obliged under the Code of Conduct to maintain effective systems and controls to mitigate risks to client confidentiality. So they're looking in a lot more other areas. It's than just a normal kind of it's been a breach, and there's a bit of an investigation looking around, like I say, around are you holding on to information too long? Should you use pseudonymization? Should you use encryption? there was measures weren't applicable for ensuring ongoing confidentiality and stuff. So I thought there's quite a lot that we could potentially for another time perhaps, or for individuals that are listening to go and pick up that case from the ICO's website. Just Google ICO enforcement action and it will highlight Tucker solicitors, as well as the one recently with Royal Mail that I think Ollie will cover off. But there's quite a few bits in there that I thought was quite interesting and learning, and I'm sure some of them will resonate with some of the clients and some of the individuals that we talk to on a regular basis because of, let's say, for example, looking at patch updates. If you've got 1,500 computers, have your old patch updates out in a sufficiently robust enough period. And like I said, this solicitor's firm took 5 months to do so. So it's a lot of learning and a lot of interesting parts to do to kind of pick over, I think.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dave. Yeah, I don't want to spend too long on it because, in all honesty, I've literally only just got back, and so I've not really followed it closely enough. But I thought it was worth raising because we're talking about fundraising today. Is this fine from the ICO, which has been handed down to the Royal Mail? I think it's to the sum of, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but something like 20 grand, maybe something to
I
that
think
effect.
I think I heard it's about 20 grand. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's all to do with direct marketing, right? It's all to do with not having the appropriate consent under PECA, etc. But I think one of the things that's particularly interesting about it, and again, if anyone has read into it more than I have, please do feel free to correct me on any of this. But I believe that what is key to it, and the reason why it's particularly interesting, is that this has come as a result not of, you know, systematic disregard for the rules, which we've seen in certain other instances of PECA fines. So, you know, we had one of the pizza places, Papa John's or Domino's or whichever one it was, you know, was systematically sending out messages without consent, X, Y, Z. In this particular case for the Royal Mail, it was just one mistake, one instance of human error where they sent out a particular email to a whole host of people. Now, I don't know the scale. I haven't got the number off the top of my head. But they sent out one email effectively to a whole list of people that shouldn't have been in receipt of it because they hadn't opted in, and that was sufficient for the ICO to get involved.
I think in that case, I don't know the right details. I think they'd actually sent an email. It's just over 200,000. I think it's about 217,000 or something like that. I think it was, but it was to individuals that had expressly asked for no further communication. So it's in essence email and suppression file.
Which is particularly relevant. We'll come on to talk about that a little bit more, won't we? But I think that's particularly interesting, you know, seeing that it's not just sort of a systematic issue which has been picked up. It's just this one-off instance, and it was a mistake from what I can tell. So whether that represents a positive shift in enforcement, I'm not entirely sure. To be honest, I've not really given it enough thought. I mean, we often moan that the ICO is not sufficiently proactive in terms of its enforcement on this particular channel. But we'll have to see how that continues to develop. I just thought it was worth raising in context. So we've got four key topics for discussion today within the broader context of fundraising, haven't we, Dave? We discussed them previously with our two guests. And one of them, I don't know if there was any that you wanted to start with in particular, but the one I've got down here first, and I know is in particular a bugbear of yours, is around basically the concept of whether someone is opting out from receiving communications or requesting to be deleted from the database altogether, which aren't necessarily always the same thing. Sometimes those are taken to mean the same thing and it might not be the case. Sometimes it's, I don't want to receive this particular type of communication or along this channel, but I'm happy to hear about other things. And I know that's been a bugbear of yours, and I think our two guests also share that. So I'll leave this one to the three of you to discuss, because you will have come up against it far more than I have.
No, for sure. And like I say, do unmute and do join in. Otherwise, you'll find I'll just rab it on until Ollie stops me. So please do feel free to jump in and take part in the conversations. But it is a particular bugbear of mine. And just before we actually get to answering the question around that, the reason why it's a bugbear of mine is because I used to love doing direct marketing. I used to love all the data analysis. I used to love working out why people responded to stuff, why didn't they respond to stuff, what confidence have we got in sending mailing packs out, really doing data analysis. And then as soon as you realise all that's unhinged by inaccurate data recording, errors, The integrity and the accuracy of the data starting to fall away, then it starts impacting on how we can communicate with people, how we can look at why people respond, why they don't respond, when we're looking at different levels of asks and different levels of gifts, whether it's a cash appeal, whether it's through raffles, we're looking at a direct debit uplift and things. We need to have value. We need to be able to have to take some kind of confidence in the data. And once you start seeing flags on the data, and this is where we're starting to move to now between objections and erasions. So once you start seeing flags on the data and then asking, well, why is that there? So for example, we may have on the database system, the system that I used when I was in the hospice sector was Thank You. And occasionally you find on the system, do not contact, which might seem on the face of it a relatively simple understanding. Do not contact means do not contact. But does it? In that sense, and this is the reason why I used to get wound up with it. Do not contact in some cases means that the major donor officer was wanting you not to contact anybody because they were putting them through some particular stewardship program. We've had do not contact because organizationally there was a corporate do not contact these individuals because the VIPs, the trustees, the board members, that kind of thing. We've also had do not contact where it's, well, we're not quite sure why it's there. Actually, it's just a flag on the system. So can we rely on it? Shall we not rely on it? Can we get past that somehow? Do we have to give weight to it? So you get this kind of you get to this kind of stalemate where you, this indecision where you can't move because you really don't know whether, well, can we rely on it? Can't we rely on it? Shall we, shan't we? This kind of thing. And it comes down to, for me at the start, like I said, before we necessarily get onto the specifics, and I know a couple might be wanting to jump in at a minute. It's all about data accuracy, because once we understand what we're doing, we've got some control measures around the database. We've got some safeguards so we know what flags we're putting there and what they mean once they're on the system, that kind of thing. Then we get a bit more kind of confidence in being able to use those records for our communication purposes and to raise the funds that we really do need to raise for the organisation and for our charitable work. But it really does get frustrating when you get flags on the system and you start asking questions. Well, what does this flag mean? And you've got some individuals and some unsure and some ambiguous kind of responses to that. So that's the reason. I just want to set the scene of my frustration before we move any further.
Yeah, it's definitely probably the case across all of our hospices or anyone that uses communications to keep in touch with people. So at our hospice, we've found historical flags, and it's trying to work out now when we flag things, who's flagging them and for what reason we're putting a do not contact. You know, is it a well-meaning volunteer manager who's decided that, you know, somebody stepped down as a volunteer and then they don't want to give them any more communications? But actually, you know, they shouldn't fall off our communication list. So yeah, it's about tighter internal procedures and clarity about how you're marking a database and whether, you know, there's somebody's opinion has swayed whether someone's put as a do not contact or whether it's just a human error that they've been put down with the wrong flag codes and things. So yeah, definitely yeah, for people sure. That drop off our communications that shouldn't, perhaps because they haven't even requested it.
And the real difficulty with that is, if let's say we're not in the charity sector, let's say we're selling something, all we need to do is increase our advertising. And if the goods were particularly interesting to people, we'll get people buying our products in a range of shape of different forces as a general kind of overview. But in the hospice sector and the charity sector, we're not technically selling anything. And what we need to do is make sure that we've got the ability to communicate. Because if you track your data and you track your appeals and the people you're communicating with, you can actually see if we don't ask, we don't generally get. In that kind of sense, we need to make sure that we've got the ability to communicate and therefore the accuracy of the data, working through, well, what have we got? Have we got control measures around it? Have we got restrictions? Have we got do we do any data validity or any kind of validity testing to make sure that what's being added by who is accurate and that kind of thing? And try and work through that process so we can keep our ability to communicate as wide as possible.
I think as well, there's something there about how we in our organisations define do not contact and making sure that our organisation as a whole has that same definition. Like Teresa said, if somebody has made that decision and there's been no definition as to what do not contact means, we're all recording different things when we receive do not contacts, as they may be or not, if the case is.
No, no, for sure. And we all do it. We're only human, aren't we? We kind of see a flag that's do not contact. We all kind of give an assumption that we can't contact them. But it's the clarity as to what the definition means is really important. It might be a very simple term, but clarity as to what actually do we mean by do not contact in that sense. Is it somebody coming back to the first point that Ollie introduced between an opt out of the mailing list or removal from the database the same thing? Well, that could be represented either way by do not contact. Do not contact by post. Do not contact ever. Do not contact have objected to my information being used in that way, in shape or form. So we do kind of need some clarity around that. Now, just to come to the point between that Ollie kind of introduced this section on in relation to if people are opting out of a mailing list. Again, it comes back to when they opt out of a mailing list, do we actually know what they're opting out from? In that sense, I've certainly come across some charities, and I've worked with a few since leaving the charity sector in the role that I'm doing at the moment, with a range, like I said, with a range of different size charities. And sometimes opting out's not necessarily clear either around the organisation. And I've certainly come across some that think, well, once we've opted out of communication or opting out of a mailing list, that means we can no longer communicate by email. And that's not necessarily so. You certainly, if they've opted out from email from a marketing point, you're going to have to give effect to that. But if you've got a customer inquiry or you've got the ability to communicate by email and you've got a service communication that you need to send them, for example, let's just say your lottery membership has expired or there's been a default or something and your lottery membership hasn't been paid and you want to communicate with somebody, then as long as it's not defined as marketing, there's no reason why you can't use the email, because the opt out under the regulations is opting out of marketing communications, not opting out of any use of their email address.
Yeah, of course. And that's something we certainly in our lottery come up against. We have a genuine reason for contacting people about their lottery memberships. Like you say, if payments have expired, and actually we communicate with our lottery players in an admin way to tell them what the results of the draw are every week. We don't market to them within that email. So we take that as, yes, we can send that to them, even if they've opted out of marketing, because it relates to their lottery plays, their lottery membership.
For sure. So when you say you don't market to them, I know the answer to this one, but when you say you do not market to them, just so we've got an understanding, when you say you don't market to them in that email, what do you mean by that? We don't market to them.
So we don't try and sell anything else within that email. We actually run two versions of that email. One, we consider it's just admin, it's just the results and what the rollover amount is at that particular point. The other version does include marketing, but that's only sent to people that have opted in specifically to receive marketing.
For sure. So where you've got the ability to communicate in that sense, you may, maybe not on all occasions, but you may kind of say something along the lines of thank you for playing the lottery. If you'd like to take a second number, that kind of like a second number campaign, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So again, then looking at that, it's really key then to kind of understand if somebody's saying I'm opting out of a mailing list, what are they opting out of in that sense? And is it clear that they're opting out of communications? Is it clear that they're actually saying we don't want any communications at all, or is it just that particular mailing list and that sort of thing? The question initially posed by Ollie was between opt out and removal. Well, you've got two different actual information rights going on there. The removal from the database is an erasure request. So if somebody says, I want removing from the database, that will stop us communicating with them at all. But when we say erasure and we're going to delete information, well, what and how do we do that? How do we give effect to that? How can we kind of demystify what all that means? And for example, under an erasure request, can we keep some of the information, for example?
I don't know who that was aimed at, or just rhetorical, David. But yeah, for things like gift aid, you want to keep a history for a period of time. For potential future legacies, you might want to keep a giving history to tie in. So there's lots of reasons why we might want to keep that data and not actually just delete it off the database.
There's also financial requirements to keeping that data. There's requirements under gambling license conditions to keep records of gambling plays. So there are many reasons why we kind of have to keep the data, but it's how much of the data we have to keep.
For sure. But both very valid suggestions there. When you look at when I was using the Thank You Dataverse, that was in essence the Dataverse that was the heart of all the fundraising. It was the heart of all the financial accounting. And if we erase some of these information because they're asked us to, and we didn't go through the process of what can we delete, when can we delete it, should we be deleting it, that would actually affected all of the financial accounting, because the gift aid was tied to it, the financial accounting was tied to it. It would have an effect on all your trend analysis and things, if you're looking at how things are performed over a period of time, that kind of thing. So it really does highlight when it comes to erasure, well, do we know how long we're keeping it for, do we know how long we can keep it for in that sense? So when you're talking gift aid, or when you're talking finances, you may find that there's a period of around about 6 to 7 years based on HMRC rules and regulations. So you can go, well, we know we've now got 6 or 7 years at least, so we don't infringe those regulations. But there may be other things. So Trudy mentioned about gambling commission requirements. So if somebody's got gambling issues and we need to make sure that we're not communicating with them, or they've asked not to be communicated with, then we may think, well, actually, that's kind of like a suppression file. It acts in the same way as when we're talking about gambling or the lottery or raffles, which is a kind of a form of gambling, comes under the gambling commission's remit. Then we need a kind of suppression file of knowing who not to talk to, so we don't infringe those regulations. And that would be the same for if an individual said, well, look, I don't want personal communications, I don't want to be on your emailing list or your mailing file somewhere. So through an erasure request, there may well be a need to keep a suppression file. So if we were in the market of purchasing cold data to try and help our fundraising activities and things, that we're not buying the details of an individual who's asked us not to communicate with them.
That's a very good point, Dave, and I'm going to jump on that last one actually for a bit of a segue, if that's all right, unless there's anything else to cover on that particular point. But I only do so because one of the other things we've got here is transferring data, but we've extrapolated that to cover really the use of any processes or suppliers that we might use in the context of fundraising, right? And that could be anything. That could be print and mailing houses, that could be as you mentioned there, so list brokers. Or even, is there a broader term for this, like organisations that will do wealth screening for you, or just prospecting generally? Not naming any names, but there are a couple of obviously very famous ones. So I think that was another topic we wanted to cover, wasn't it, Dave? So that's probably a good opportunity to cover them and some of the implications that might come with that from a compliance perspective.
For sure. I don't know if Teresa or Trudy wants to start, if you're happy for me just to jump straight in.
You go for it, David.
Yeah, go for it.
No, that's fine. Like I said, if anybody's got any questions or queries, do drop them in the chat, do a mute, do raise your hand, that kind of thing. Ollie will keep his eye in the chat section, and I will raise them on your behalf if you want to. So it's your forum for you to take as much as you can from today's session, and so do please raise questions if you're sat there holding any. But absolutely, when Ollie was talking about looking at kind of data transfers, well, we need to do stuff, okay? Sharing information with organisations, not just the charity sector, but organisations really wouldn't be able to operate if we weren't allowed to share data in that sense. And we share data for a whole range of reasons. Some of them are really obvious. You might get a police request in that sense. The mayor will be sharing where you've got external suppliers offering us support services, whether that's from a payroll, outsourced HR, whether you're looking at fundraising, you're looking at things like DotMailer or another form of email platform through your email communications. You may outsource the whole of your lottery like we did when I was in a hospice sector. So then there's information sharing to a complete other organisation that's managing it all on our behalf. As we used it's not the BBC, I'm sure we can name people. We used Sterling Lotteries at that point. There was information transfers going backwards and forwards. They managed the whole setup of the lottery for us in that sense. So it wasn't just us sending information to them. We had to get the information back and things. So the organisation, we wouldn't be able to operate if we didn't do that. But, well, how do we do that compliantly? Whether it's the lottery, whether it's door-to-door fundraisers that doing kind of community fundraising events for us, whether it's printing mailing houses, direct marketing agencies such as Prospecting for Gold or Pebble Beach or one of those other ones, how do we make sure that we do that safely? And it's understanding what we're sending them and why we're sending the information to them. Now, some of that might be obvious in that sense. It's making sure that some of the information that we sent is secure. So how are we going to do it in a secure way? And what does that look like? And to go through those measures. But from a compliance point, we need to make sure that we've got appropriate data processing agreements in place for those organisations, because we retain the obligations as a controller. We're appointing another organisation to do something purely on our behalf. They're not interested in doing it otherwise. They're only doing it because we've asked them to do it. So therefore, they're operating as a processor. And we just need to make sure that we've got appropriate processing agreements in place where there's regular systematic between ourselves. OK, so that's where we need to make sure that we've got those requirements in place with those organisations. And the other step we need to start thinking about is just a little bit of due diligence around those organisations as well. You might have a supplier A and a supplier B in that kind of setup. And you're kind of thinking, well, who are we going to use? Are we going to use supplier A? Or are we going to use supplier B? And that's where the due diligence comes in, to try and work out, well, what are they going to do once they've got the information? Not just what we're going to ask them, but how do they hold it? How do they protect it on our behalf and that kind of stuff? So we need to just go through those steps around the bits of due diligence with those organisations. Is there anything you wanted to kind of come in and add anything there, either Tracy or Trudy or anybody else?
Just to raise something that I'm sure people have considered, and I know I mentioned it the other day, depending on how organisations are set up. In our organisation, we, as St Anne's Hospice, we are a charity and then a separate trading company. And our lottery and our retail sits under the trading company. So there's a data sharing process, or multiple data sharing processes, between the trading company and the hospice. So that's something that we had to address and have agreements in place for that data transfer.
Absolutely, Val. Yeah, internal between, because like you said, the retail is an independent trading arm. It's got its own legal entity in its own right. It's working very hard to help fund income generation of the organisation, but it's a separate entity in that sense. And there's an information flow between the two. And the ICO guidance on information flows and sharing will actually pick up on, I think it uses one of those as an example. Another kind of case study similar to what Trudy came out with as an example of where you maybe need kind of inter-organisational agreements where there's flows between different parts within the group structure, if you want to class it as a group structure.
Yeah, we've got to remember that for our supporters, our donors, our lottery players, they see us as one organisation. So where a query, a change of contact details, for example, might come in through the trading company, it actually might apply to the whole organisation if that supporter donates in other ways to us. So we have to have that agreement in place to kind of not inconvenience the supporter, to say, that's great, you've told the trading company, but you need to tell the hospice separately. We have to make things as easy as possible for our supporters.
For sure. And that comes back to the point we were talking about earlier in relation to data accuracy and the quality of the data. Because as you mentioned, some of the individuals and supporters that support through the retail arm, and their information may well be on something like Cybertill. The retail's operating completely independently, so they're doing their own gift aid claims, because that's slightly different to gift aid through fundraising and bits and pieces. So the individual may advise them that their details have changed, and without an appropriate measure in place to ensure that's replicated around the organisation, you may find from a fundraising point that there's then an integrity issue with the data, because what's on the fundraising database may not be the single source of truth if you thought it was, if you've not got this flow of information to update things between, in essence, your Cybertill, if that's the system that you use, and your fundraising database.
Yeah, it's making sure those dots are all joined up, which is... if you've got different databases and some of them cloud with data sharing agreements with third party providers and things, yeah, it's making sure that that jigsaw all joins up, which it doesn't in the case. But it's what we do about it when it doesn't go right. And, you know, somebody's deceased on two databases, but not on a third one, and then they get marketing communication. So it's about how we react to problems that happen. And hopefully breaches are few and far between. But, you know, occasionally we will get it wrong and send something out to somebody we shouldn't. So.
For sure. And you only have to kind of think through some of the examples you spoke about just in this session, where we've got somebody opting out of communication, saying, well, actually, I don't want to receive the communication from you anymore. That kind of thing. If that was fed through to the retail arm and you didn't have this ability, and you didn't have the safeguards in there for that information to come back, the fundraising side of things, or your individual giving team, may well then be communicating with somebody that's objected through the retail arm, and it's making sure that we can give effect to that. Because if there was an issue with the ICO, and I'm not suggesting there's going to be a huge crawler, so I'm not trying to scare people here, but if there was an issue with the ICO and the ICO is investigating, they would certainly expect the organisation to have a correct measure in place to facilitate that kind of thing. If you had an objection to communications received by your retail arm, they'd expect some kind of measure in place to bring that back into the wider organisation.
Someone's put in the chat, Jerry, I don't know from which hospice they're from, Jerry, but looks like they were really well supported by the ICO when they had a breach. So that's really reassuring to hear, you know, that we're not just going to get the worst things happen to us. Hopefully they would support us through a process if something happened.
100%, Teresa, I was just about to raise that for those who haven't seen. Jerry shared some fantastic insight there into the chat about a breach and saying that how good the ICO were, including sort of holding their hand through the process of writing to over 35,000 individuals in the wake of the breach. And moral of the story, speak to the ICO, they're extremely helpful. And funnily enough, Dave, I mean, for those who are regulars to this session, they might be aware of this, but this is what we hear pretty much consistently across the board, isn't it? That there's a real fear of the ICO as the regulator, and possibly some of that has to do with us as professionals and the way that we portray it. And, you know, that's a different conversation. But that ultimately, in almost every instance that we've been involved in, the ICO have been extremely helpful. You know, they've been very sort of supportive, and really that it's an opportunity to improve your processes and to get some great guidance. I completely agree with what Jerry's saying at this speak.
I would certainly second that. The ICO have proved quite useful and quite appropriate advice with organisations. In that sense, it does come into its own though, where you can demonstrate that you've got a good setup to start. When you've had a breach, I've certainly worked with some organisations that have had some horrendous breaches. That's avoided any kind of sanctions and enforcement action by the ICO, because in essence, they were able to demonstrate that they were well led, that they were well governed, that they understood their obligations, that the measures in place were appropriate, and in essence, the incident that happened wasn't systemic of wider concerns within the organisation, but actually was an isolated one-off issue. Not trying to suggest through a root cause analysis that human error is possibly an output from a root cause, as there's a lot of other bits you need to consider as part of a root cause analysis. But still, in essence, it was one of those things that's happened. It's not systemic. And in that sense, then working with the ICO to address things can be really, really beneficial. The ICO tend to get more upset where they've highlighted things and it's been ignored, or you're really not trying to give any effect to what your obligations are, that kind of thing. So do try to work with inside the law. Do try to be able to evidentially demonstrate that, and you are automatically on the right foot with the ICO when you need to start talking to them. But I also found, as what Ollie alluded to, that some organisations are really, really quite shy of talking to the ICO, and the ICO do provide some suitable advice. We've had some organisations that don't want to communicate with the ICO because they feel it's going to put them on the radar of the ICO. And I'm not quite sure where that kind of myths come from. I don't know if you've come across anything similar, anybody or Ollie, but I've certainly found some organisations really are quite shy in that if they needed to ask for some advice through the ICO, they've asked us to do it on their behalf because they don't want to end up on the radar. But I think that's I've not actually seen that come out in practice from the ICO's point. So I think there's a few myths about what the ICO may do that maybe needs dispelling as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I think, you know, as I alluded to previously, and it's possibly not the topic for today, but possibly some of that is to do with how sometimes we as, so if we're the DPO or the privacy lead, or we're involved in governance in any way, there can be a temptation there to get the point across when you're lacking the buy-in to start hammering down the door and saying, look board, look, you know, frontline staff, if we don't do this, the ICO are going to come down on us, you know, 4% or 2% fines of your global value turnover, et cetera, et cetera. I think there can be a temptation to do that, and maybe that's where it comes from to an extent. But, you know, I also think that's understandable in context. And that there is more of an apprehension. Maybe part of it has to come from the ICO in terms of how they represent themselves. I don't know. There might not be a straightforward answer, but you're definitely right that there are some myths that need dispelling on that front, because they can be very helpful. They can also step on the fence sometimes about things if you ask them, but generally they are found to be very helpful. I don't know if there's any more to talk about on that specific topic, but just to come back around to fundraising, Dave.
Just before we get onto that, I don't often look in the chat, but with you being away, Ollie, I do tend to have it open now and then. And I absolutely applaud what Jerry has said, where he's happy to share lessons learned with anybody from the breach because you're much stronger because of it. You will emerge much stronger because of it. Some of the organisations I've worked with, I've urged them to share with the sector the learnings that they've had. Unfortunately, I don't know whether it's just because it's seen quite negative, people don't want to talk about it, or because it's seen quite negative that they feel that there's going to be a lot more connotations to it. But a lot of these breaches could have happened by anybody. In that sense, some of them come from the simplest of things that then just snowball and unfortunately then become a bit of a beast in its own right, unfortunately. And there is a lot of learning. And I think instead of looking at the negatives, you should look at the positives of what we got right and how we've put things right and how others can learn from that. And I'd absolutely applaud that, because the couple of organisations I've got in mind aren't in the charity sector, but there's certainly a lot of organisations would do well by learning from what they had in place prior to the breach and what they did as a consequence of the breach, and then thinking about contingency plans based around that and actually turning what in essence is quite a negative or let's say negative output, turning it into a positive, because there's usually some really strong bits that you can take from that. So getting back to the direct marketing side of things, so we looked at data transfers, we've looked at the fact that we need to share information with organisations. Just prior to leaving the data transfer, we looked at it quite narrowly in the sense that we need agreements in place, and we need to do a bit of due diligence. We also need to work out that if we are going to be sharing information with organisations, that we are actually quite transparent about doing that within our privacy policy, and that we actually advise people through our privacy policy, privacy notifications, that we do work with external parties, that we do take privacy and confidentiality seriously, that these organisations that we work with are there to support the hospice. We're certainly not selling data, but we do need to work with organisations when we're doing direct marketing. We do need to work with organisations when we're looking at the lottery arm and so on and so forth. So it's about being clear about transparent about why we're using them, and that then kind of links clearly into, we need to be also doing that if we're doing any form of wealth screening. I was certainly in the sector when we had the issues many years ago now with Olive Cook and Samuel Ray, and the birth of the fundraising regulator around that. So we do need to be really, really clear. If we're doing wealth screening using organisations such as Prospecting for Gold and things, we need to make sure that we're being absolutely clear and transparent about that. That's happening. And also then, if individuals object to that, saying, well, I don't want to be well screened, how do we do that? How do we give effect to that? How do we measure that against our database? And how do we then come back to the starting point of how can I rely on that data? So what control measures and bits and pieces are we putting around to make sure that how we update the system is done in an appropriate way, that we can all have faith in the data. Did you want to add anything else there, Ollie?
No, you're running this on your own. Clearly, being away for a week has really helped in that regard. I think I'll let you do them in future.
It's definitely spurring me on to think about our privacy statement and just to revisit it and what we say we do and make sure that's all clear and up to date.
I think that's a valuable takeaway, because it should be periodically reviewed anyway. A lot of the measures we're talking about from a compliance point needs to have some kind of cyclical review process to that. I'm certainly not saying everything needs reviewing on a 12-month basis, but we certainly need to show that we've put something in place, that we're maintaining it, and it is actually still fit for purpose in that sense. So it's absolute really, really valuable that we need to periodically review our privacy policy, especially if we know we're doing something different. If we've introduced a new style of income generating, that kind of thing, and we're looking at new projects and processes, that we kind of think, well, as part of this, let's just pull in the wider governance around that, whether it's a privacy policy, whether it's looking at our records processing activities, whether it's the fact that we maybe even need to do a risk assessment. And if we're going to do a risk assessment, well, what type of things are we looking for within that? So looking at there was a couple of other questions. A couple of other points I think that was raised for us to have a look at, and one was in relation to data retention, I think it was.
Yes, indeed.
Have we got any more specifics around that, Ollie?
Well, just data retention more broadly is a topic. I mean, obviously, the subject of data retention is massive, right? And it's, well, I don't know, I'm happy for anyone to challenge this, but I feel like it's one of the big ones, which is often a struggle for organisations. But I thought that in this context, because obviously we could spend an hour talking about retention in and of itself, I thought we'd talk more specifically around possibly database management, and because it links in to what we've discussed thus far. So I don't know what your experience, Dave, and also Teresa and Trudy, has been like in terms of managing your fundraising database or your lottery database, and in terms of applying retention criteria to that, how efficient that's been, whether you've had any insight from going through that process, because I know from experience that retention can be so difficult, although it can be facilitated, I think, by systems where they allow you to do that. So I think there's probably a lot to cover in there, but I don't know if anyone's got some learning or some issues, some bones of contention to share off the bat in relation to that.
Yeah, I would probably started by how long is too long? If we can keep information, how long can we keep it for, and how long would be too long? Which might sound a rather loose kind of question, but it's ones I get faced all the time by some charities that we work with in relation to data retention. We've got some clear ones around there. We mentioned them earlier around about the finances and around a gift aid, where you've got minimum kind of retention periods. But let's say we've passed that minimum retention period, or let's just say actually he's talking about a donor. And we've got somebody on the database and we're looking at retention. So at what point does the trigger for retention start? Let's pose that as a kind of a question. So is it, let's say, is it when an individual stops donating in that sense? So then, let's use that as an example. So we've got an individual has stopped donating and it's been a period of time. You may have donor journeys or some kind of marketing communications around donors being active, potentially moving into lapsed or long-term lapsed or other kind of terms for that. So at what point do you start thinking we maybe need to start deleting their data and complying with the data retention principle? And that can be very, 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 very difficult to determine, because when I was in the sector, and I'm opening this up to anybody else, and to Teresa and Trudy, is that when I was in the sector, we certainly had a lot of engagement from individuals that weren't necessarily heavy donors, but enjoyed receiving the news magazine, the newsletter that went out twice a year. Maybe weren't heavy on donations, they were maybe in the socio-demographic element, or because of age and pensions and bits and pieces. Their giving history would have potentially suggested, if we based it on the giving history, we would have maybe not communicated with them for a long time, if we were only communicating to people that have given, shall we say. Whereas they're still doing great work in the community. They're still talking about when I was in the hospice sector, certainly talking about the work and the support that we provided. They would occasionally turn up to coffee meetings and may well shop through the retail arm, but not necessarily feeding that back through to the supporter database. When we're looking at retention and a retention trigger, I'm not quite sure if in all cases, basing it purely on the last gift is necessarily narrowing the ability to communicate again. And maybe pushing us down the line that we need to think a little bit more about.
Yeah, you've made a really good point there about people who support us, but maybe not financially. You know, they could be going into our charity shops, but they're not making one-off donations or in-mem donations or members of the lottery. So it's, how long do we keep these people for? How long do we communicate with them for? I think we're all price conscious, so you'll try and stretch your budget to those who are more responsive when you send things, but it's trying to work out what your objectives are for either different appeals, or whether it's newsletter and it's all about communication firstly, financially second. So yeah, it's really interesting, how long do we keep these people for if they're not, we can't track their response rates.
So is most people's kind of direct marketing campaigns based off, if you're active, it's based off active donations or active in other ways? How do we determine what active is in that sense?
For us, it's definitely financially active, or they've signed up for an event or something. So that, you know, that we can see that they've done something and contributed. So we will still communicate with people who may not have responded for 12 months or 2 years, but we probably wouldn't go back further than that.
No, for sure. And it's quite tricky, isn't it? Because like you said, regardless of the retention bit, and we can try and give a bit more guidance around the retention bit, regardless of that, there is the economic cost of, well, if we're keeping people on the database, we're going to communicate with them and it's not generating an income, and we can't show that it's going to generate an income in the future, then it's a case of, it's a cost-benefit analysis of, well, how long do we communicate with an individual in that sense? Can we demonstrate that such an approach will ultimately end up in a legacy or not, in that kind of sense? So how long is too long when you've got the commercial aspect of actually still communicating with people? Because every time we pop something in the post, as we were, the biggest element of putting a mailing pack together is the postal element of it, and the postal fees just seem to be going up year on year at the moment, aren't they? I think it was in the news recently that, is it first class going to go to about 95p? Mailing discounts, bulk mailing and that kind of stuff, but prices are still going up. So you're absolutely right with the commercial element on it. But if we just put the commercial element to one side for the moment, if you're thinking, well, what do we class activity on? That may well be a donation. It may well be the fact that they've undertaken an event. If we can track or find some way of tracking the information through the retail, that might also open up and demonstrate that they're a little bit more active. In that sense, potentially not directly attributable to the data, to the fundraising database, but they are a little bit more active in that sense. Andy Godfrey, your hands come up.
I don't work for a hospice. I work for a care home organisation that's also a charity. And we switched middle of last year from consents to legitimate interest for all of our donors. And we've taken the stance that the engagement is anything that we get back. So they don't necessarily need to give, but as long as they respond. So in our newsletters, for example, we started putting in word search quizzes to try to engage feedback to us. And with each interaction, we give them the opt-out if they want to. But we've tended to find that by keeping that ongoing interaction with people, even though that might not be anything financial at that time, a lot of legacy givers leave it very late until they actually choose to become a legacy giver. Mm-hmm. And so just by maintaining that ongoing trickle of interactions, we've actually found it very helpful.
I think that's a really useful suggestion, because you're demonstrating that somebody's still engaged with the organisation, it's not directly financially linked. You're keeping your database in that. Since you've moved from consent for postal communications to legitimate interest for communications, so you're keeping your ability to communicate as wide as you can, not narrowing it down by under consent. You're not narrowing it in the sense that you're basing it purely on a kind of an income-driven element to it. You're keeping it as wide as you can by saying, well, if you can communicate in some way or other, whether that's through responding with a word search or a customer service query, or look, we're needing, we've got a particular event on, can you do something in order to support that event? Might not be monetary driven, but just trying to drive interactions is a great way to keep your database open and active for longer. And then your retention periods will still apply once that inactivity ends. But what you're trying to do is make sure that inactivity isn't based purely on a financial look in that sense. I get the argument about the commercial side of things, but I think that's a really, really useful suggestion, Andy.
Thank you.
So once we've kind of been through all of that, then we need to start to think about, well, we maybe need to give effect to things at some point from a retention point. So therefore, we then need to start thinking about, well, how are we going to look at building a retention schedule? What we're going to decide. Now, there's some bits within a retention schedule that we're going to have to give effect to as a minimum number of years that we can keep things for. So for tax purposes, financial services, gift aid, that kind of thing, you'll probably find within the requirements, possibly even for the Gambling Commission as well, that kind of thing, you've got a period of a minimum period of at least 6 or 7 years, that kind of thing, in order so the HMRC can challenge it, they can come and have a look at your gift aid certifications and stuff. But how long do we keep the information after that? And therefore, that'll be a straight, in essence, down to an organisational decision of can you find a reasonable point in time that would suggest, and potentially can we justify it, can we find a reasonable point in time to say, well, actually, after this period, we should be okay to start considering deleting the data. So, for example, you might find a longer period of time for suppression files. You might say, well, actually, because we don't want to purchase cold data with an individual that's asked not to be communicated with, because the organisational decision was not to communicate with these individuals, because of some upset or some grievance or something that had gone in the background, you may say, well, actually, we need to keep that information for the purposes of suppression. But it doesn't necessarily mean you need to keep all of the information for suppression. You only need to keep the minimum amount for suppression. So therefore, you might start thinking, well, actually, in order to give effect to privacy, in order to give effect to the law, what we'll start doing is looking at information about those individuals in that subset of individuals that we're looking at and thinking, well, what can we minimise? What can we start to delete? Well, if we're never going to communicate with them by telephone, we only need the name address that's there. I know an email just in case we want to purchase email addresses. Then we can start thinking, and possibly the finances, because we looked earlier, the fact that the finance might be linked to the how finances are accounted. But you might be start thinking, well, I don't need their interactions with communications that we've had, and maybe don't need to know what mailings we've sent them over the time. We start maybe trying to minimise some of that information to show that we're giving effect as best we can to the retention principle in relation to some of the details that we're retaining.
I'm going to stay silent at this point because this is something we don't necessarily do very well, but I'm scribbling furious notes down.
Scribbling notes furiously. If it helps, I've not seen many organisations do it particularly well. What I have seen is organisations having a really good your core obligatory paperwork, or your documentation. So they've got really good ROPAs, they've got a really good retention schedule. But when it actually comes to saying, have you hit the delete button on anything? Then that's normally the point where there's a pause, and that pause then becomes a period of quite a bit of inactivity. Because when you're looking at data retention, let's not miss the point that we're just not looking at deleting data off the CRM system, for example. You may find that you've got emails with personal data in it. You may find that you've done business insight reports, or you might have extracted some information off the database that's got the CRM ID, a URN number against the files. You might find that it's got that you've saved those files for analysis, and you got those against a common file. It's all those files that we also need to be thinking about. We're not just talking CRM systems, we're not just talking lottery databases and things and looking at retention. We're looking at anywhere that personal data is held, whether it's emails, whether it's in personal drives because we've done data analysis, whether it's within output files or response handling files back from the printer mailing house if they do the response handling element. We need to start thinking about, well, where is the data? Who's got access to it? So we're looking at retention. That also then brings in third-party suppliers. So how long are they holding our information for? And when can we start asking them to delete it? And should they be deleting it and that kind of thing? So we've certainly got a retention with those that we share information with, especially from a processor point. We've got a retention point with our CRM systems, but anywhere else that information may exist. So we've got, like you say, you've got emails, you potentially got your network drives where files are held and saved. We're also talking paper documents. So anybody that's still holding paper versions of gifted certificates and things, what do we do about those? Has anybody got any specific kind of questions and things?
I haven't, Dave. You seem to have you seem to have absolutely floored us all. One of the things I wanted to pick up on, because I'm not sure it had been, but just on that retention point, I think worth doubling back on this because it's something that I've seen come up a lot, particularly with other clients of mine. What Christine's saying in the chat, which is that they've asked their database provider for advice on how to delete/anonymize old data, and they've been no help at all. And I know for a fact that it's something you've also seen in the past where, unfortunately, organizations, whether it's within this specific sector or not, are simply not supported by the providers, when really it could potentially be, you know, relatively easy and you'd think commercially viable fix for them to you know, look at.
Yes, it's a really interesting question from Christine there in relation to the database provider, because I've found a couple of things with it. One, as an individual or as an organisation, you're sometimes between a rock and a hard place because you know you need to delete stuff, but the systems don't allow you to do it in an automated fashion, and you really haven't got the resources whether that's manpower volunteers and things, to sit there looking through the records that you got and trying to give effect to it in a manual way. So it's very much a rock and a hard place. And then the other element I've also found is that if systems aren't designed in order to give effect to retention, in order to assist with either anonymizing or deleting data, then potentially is the system actually fit for purpose? Because retention is not something that's just come up under the GDPR. You still had a retention obligation under the old 1998 Act in that sense. And the bit that really frustrates me, I know I always end up getting onto a bit of a soapbox, Ollie, but the thing that really frustrates me with some of the software providers is when you start asking about things like automated retention and can you assist with retention, the ones that do it often say yes, but that comes at a fee because it's an upgrade to what you've paid for. And that is a real, real bugbear of mine.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It is a real bugbear. Just to cover off again, I'm trying to keep an eye on the chat, but what Jerry's saying I think is perfectly valid, despite how, and I know what you mean, Jerry, in terms of how it comes across, which is not teaching anyone to suck eggs, but it's really important we know what personal data we are holding and where it is held. If not, when you get a subject access request, you'll be in a real flat to meet the statutory deadline. And that's a really good point. It sounds daft and it almost sounds condescending to a point, right, to say, do you actually know what you hold and where it is? Because, yeah, that can be quite a demeaning thing. But really, actually, it's a very good point because a lot of organisations don't necessarily have that control. And it's one of the things I pick up in DPIAs all the time is saying, well, you know, if a SAR or an erasure request or whatever it might be came in, would you not just be able to deal with it, but would you be able to deal with it efficiently? Are you set up to be able to retrieve the information, to query whatever database you're using, and actually, you know, export that in the format you need? Because all too often there's this assumption, I guess, and this is potentially slightly unfair, but that we do know where it is and we'll be able to make do. And a lot of the time, you know, that can be yeah, a bit of a false equivalent, really, can't it? It's not always necessarily the case.
Yeah, it certainly can, and quite scarily, when I've done audits and I've asked people about that, they tend to think that it's an IT issue. So IT knows where it is. You kind of go, will it? What do you mean IT will know where it is? Well, IT set the network up. IT can kind of do this, that, and the other. So IT, if we need to know where it is, IT can support us. And you're kind of going, well, I'm not quite sure. IT can be very, very good, but I've also got a lot of time for people who work in IT because it's... especially around, again, not trying to jump back to retention, but I've been in meetings actually where they said the issue about retention is IT and it should be IT that's managing retention. And the reason why I remember the meeting particularly well is because the individual in the IT team there went basically along the lines of, well, if it's my issue, I'll delete the lot. And that, at that point, everybody, well, you can't just delete it. And he goes, well, that's just proved the point. It's not my issue. I can help you protect it. I can help you look after it. We can work together to try and establish how do we do this in an efficient way. But the actual how long you keep information for is not an IT issue in that sense. So I've got a lot of time for them. But coming back to Jerry's point, if Jerry wants to unmute, please do unmute and jump in. It's a really, really valid point. Like you said, we're not necessarily saying nobody's doing this. It's not necessarily coming from the point of teaching people to suck eggs, but it's useful sometimes just to kick around some of these elements around what's important. Jerry's quite rightly highlighted that if we're holding on to information, we're not sure where it is, or we've got too much of it because we're not applying retention, then that really makes a subject access request can be quite difficult. Now, as a sector, I've not seen many subject access requests received. I might not, it might only be the ones I've been exposed to, but I've not seen many received from donors, but I've seen them certainly received from employees within the charity sector, if not the donors yourselves, because most organisations, most of the charities I've worked with really do respect and value the donors and they try to do everything they can to keep the donor happy. So I've never seen a great level of details. If anybody has, please do jump in. I've never seen a great number of details being received from the charity sector, from the donors or the supporters. But I'm not saying it's not improbable. I've just not necessarily come across it. But the point that Jerry makes is still very valid. In addition to, let's say, for example, you suddenly had a data breach. Go back to what we looked at earlier on when we started this session. We're kicking around the define that took a solicitor's had, and that kind of stuff. The ICO was still considered at that point, despite the fact that it was ransomware, is the fact that they weren't complying with minimization. They weren't not minimization, so they weren't applying with storage limitation and things. So it's, you are still up. If we're not getting retention right, yes, absolutely, there's a subject access request issue. But the more we have, the more we potentially risk losing under a potential breach. And that may well potentially then start adding up with the severity.
I don't know who's got their hand up. I can't work out who it is, but we've never had a subject.
It's Jerry. I just wanted to say, because I know sometimes when I'm typing, people are thinking, oh, God, he's a big head. He's got it perfect. We are we're a long way of being off perfect, but we actually had data registers and we had retention guides and what have you. When we were breached, we definitely didn't get it right. But when the ICO looked at us and said, you've tried your best. You haven't done it very well, but you've tried your best. That's why I think we had no action taken against us. And as we've got so much better because of that. Now, we thought we only had three lots of data. We had patient data, staff data, and donor data. Once we were breached, we realized we've got something like 92 different sets of data, and we're a small organization. But just by us trying to do the right thing, even though we didn't get it right, we didn't have any action taken against us. So it's definitely, we learned, because our CEO used to say, we're a small charity, no one's going to hack us. We were hacked. So it was quite serious. But as I said in the chat, if anyone wants just to give me a buzz at any time, I'm happy to tell you what we learned from it. And, you know, and learn from, I stutter, which is why I type, and we can all learn, because I'll learn a bit off all of you and you'll all learn a bit off me as well, perhaps. But there you go, shut up there.
I would support anybody who's interested to give Jerry a call. I think it's a really valuable offer there, Jerry. And likewise, if you want to jump on a call, Jerry, I'm more than happy to listen to what you've learned, listen to what went wrong and how you've addressed that. I'm really interested in, like I said, the ability to learn from each other and to be opened up to everybody else's experiences. I think that's a really valuable prospect for everybody. I'm not trying to overload you. You may be going to get 15, 20 calls this afternoon. So in that sense, but I think it's a really valuable offer.
For sure. Thanks, Jerry.
I think you've got a lot to share with other hospices, Jerry, because I think we all find with anything in life, you learn from your mistakes, don't you? You learn from issues. And if you can learn from other people's mistakes and issues, it can help you put measures in place to minimise us having the same kind of hazards and trips.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. And it's something we talk about a lot and on this channel is, you know, championing the collaborative approach between all of us, because it can be easy sometimes to get a little bit isolated as the DPO or the privacy lead or whoever you might be within the organization, and you know, get a little bit end up in a bit of an echo chamber, and having that ability to share knowledge is always so valuable. There was one other point that we were supposed to cover, but I think, to be honest, we've probably already covered it, which is in relation to communication preferences in fundraising specifically, but I think we've probably, if not indirectly, covered that. The only reason that I cover that now is because we've actually overrun already by 5 minutes, Dave. I've not been paying attention. This is terrible. You see, I take some time off and I'm all rusty. I've not been paying attention properly, and I've let you run away with this one. And I need to keep a lid on it, because otherwise we'll end up talking all afternoon, won't we? So
all I was going to say was just very quickly on yes. the communication preference comes back to what we started with, really, is understanding what do we mean by a preference. Are we actually saying the preference is a law, and therefore if somebody says we only want to communicate by email, is that an opt-in, opt-out of email? What do we actually mean by preference? Does it mean, well, actually we'll give effect to it where we can, but we're still going to communicate through any of the channels we need to if there's a major incident, and let's say, for example, that through high storms a tree had fallen on the hospice and we needed some urgent repairs and some funds to give effect to those repairs. You certainly, again, don't want necessarily to overly narrow your database in that sense. When we're looking at communication preferences is actually, you know, is that in essence, I'm not trying to be rude by saying this, but is in essence, is that just to help us kind of be more effective with our communications through efficient spends, or are we actually talking about trying to give effect to what the law requires? So it just comes back to being clear really around preferences. What do we mean by them? How do we give effect to them? Database management in that sense, and what the terms mean.
Yeah, 100%, completely agree. On that note, Teresa, Trudy, I think we're probably going to bring it to a close, but any final thoughts from either of you on any of the topics that we've discussed today? I mean, this is the thing, right? It's in theory quite a narrow topic, but there's so much to talk about, and hopefully we've done justice to most of these topics. But any closing thoughts from either of you on anything that we've discussed today, or anything particular that you'd like to share with the group before we adjourn?
I think for me, it's been really useful actually to highlight perhaps what we're doing right and where we need to look at what we're perhaps not doing right, and also to appreciate that we're not on our own. There's every organisation is in the same position. There's things we get right, and like Jerry shared his experience, that's really, really useful. And yeah, it's been really useful. So I do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
The lasting bit for me really is the fact that the ability to share knowledge in a forum like this, whether you join our regular sessions or whether we start looking at maybe having a periodic session just for the hospice sector, the ability to share knowledge and to learn from each other is really, really valuable in that sense, in order to help each other through. It can often feel quite a lonely place, and sometimes when you're starting out in data protection or when you're kind of lumbered with everything in data protection, you can, not only can it feel lonely, you can feel a little bit lost, and you might be dealing with individuals that feel a little bit scared about it as well. So any way that we can kind of demystify it, any way that we can kind of simplify it a little bit for you, I think anything like that, whether it's through this forum and you want future forums like this, and if you do reach out and let us know, and we'll certainly put additional sessions on, or whether it's through your own networks, whether that's through the Hospice Income Generation Network, whether it's through the Hospice Lottery Association or other ones, do please collaborate, because it's the way that we can all learn from each other and demystify things and make it feel a little less lonely for those with the responsibility for it.
100%. Teresa, any closing thoughts?
I think so much has been said today that, yeah, it's good to know what we're doing right. It's good to give ourselves some action. So I'm going to try and minimise the fear a bit and put some actions in about revisiting privacy policies and just things like that. Simple things that hopefully then will just help us if we ever get ourselves into any sticky situations, but hopefully we won't. But no, I found it really useful. Thank you so much for having me on, and it's been really nice to see the chat from everybody as well.
No, thank you for coming on, and thank you to you also, Trudy. And yes, completely agree. This always good to have an opportunity just to think about what we could be doing, some quick wins, if anything, that we could just go and take a look at and make sure that we're all in order. So on that note, let's bring this one to a close. Thank you all very much for your time. Thank you for attending. We hope that was useful. These are regular sessions. So we run a podcast every Friday that then goes out as a recording. They are alternating between what we call GDPR radio, which is basically just an open surgery where we talk about what's been in the news, just things that we need to get off our chest sometimes, right, Dave? Have a bit of a moan. But yeah, they're really useful, an opportunity for anyone to come in and share some insight. And then every other week we have themed sessions. So obviously this was a specific themed one. If there's an appetite for it, we can obviously look to do more specifically for the hospice sector, perhaps from a clinical side in future, or more broadly in terms of fundraising. If any of that's of interest to you, reach out to us across any of our socials, get in touch, and we'll be able to set you up with the relevant invites. For the time being, I'm going to leave you on that. Thank you, Dave, again for your time. Thank you to Trudy and Teresa for your contributions, and to all those in attendance for your contributions and your time. It's very much appreciated. We hope to see you all very soon, but for now, have a lovely weekend and we'll catch up with you soon.
Take care, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.